It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you very much for joining me this morning and hope that you really have a great week and the great outdoors coming up as so many seasons are opening and getting underway. Many already have been. As you know, the last couple of weeks I'm back from Alaska where it was spectacular and I also learned a great deal. And I did receive a call from an individual in the governor's office after last week's show who asked me to make a comment, and I thought it was a worthwhile comment, so I'm going to pass it on. His comment was this: the governor and most elected officials in Alaska, as well as the people of Alaska, believe that we became a state in 1959, not to be a ward of the United States, but to be a contributor to the economy of the United States. And his comment was, you've talked about fishing and you've talked about the incredible natural resources and the incredible beauty of Alaska. And he said, ultimately, Alaskans should be the determinants of how we use our land, not everyone in the lower 48, and particularly those in Washington who've never been to Alaska or don't understand the cultures or the wildlife, people, etc. And I thought that was really, it was really an interesting, thought-provoking comment, because there's no question that we in the lower 48, and particularly Congress, decides what's going to happen in Alaska. And as coming into the statehood, Alaska was known to have tremendous natural resources, and that was one of the great reasons to bring it in. It would be a contributor to the U.S. economy. So the comment from the governor's office was, when we talk about locking up vast tracts of land in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other areas, we need to recognize that when we do that, we are taking away Alaska's ability not only to fund itself, but to fund America and the economic engine of America. And he said, nobody in Alaska wants to be a ward or be dependent on Washington for funding. And he said, Alaskans who live here care more about our natural resources and how we live and how we hunt and how we fish than people sitting in Washington, D.C., who only know about Alaska from something they might have seen in television or what they've read. But 99% of them, in his words, 99.99% of them, have never been to Alaska to understand the vastness of the land and how all of this comes together to make Alaska vibrant. And I thought that was really an interesting way to put things, because it does come across often that we in the lower 48 are going to tell Alaska what to do. And that's been happening with regularity. And certainly Alaska doesn't appreciate it. It has arguably the world's greatest natural resources, fisheries, wildlife, etc., because it's been taken care of. And as the governor's office pointed out, it's been taken care of by Alaskans. He said it's Alaskans that stopped the whalers from the East Coast 100 years ago from coming over and taking whales. And he said it's Alaskans who stopped the fishermen from the Pacific Northwest, particularly Washington and Oregon, from coming up and depleting our fishing stocks. So they asked me, and I think I'm passing on a word, but I agree with it, to recognize that Alaskans should be sovereign, just as we are in Illinois, to make our own decisions on many issues, and that the federal government doesn't need to inject itself into everyday life in Alaska, and that Alaskans can manage quite well their natural resources because they're the ones who live there and they're the ones who deal with the consequences if something goes wrong. And they also, as he pointed out, are the engine right now for so much of America's natural resources that we depend on. And that as we continue to, from Washington, lock up areas that are never to be used for anything but what they are right now, he said, we do not take into consideration their economic value, their cultural value, and frankly, the fact that environments change and that the environmental values change over time. So anyway, that was an interesting call, and I wanted to pass it on to those of you who've listened the last couple of weeks, which probably leads me into something else that I marvel at, and that is in this presidential election cycle, where is the discussion? I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but now we're just a month out. Where is the discussion of conservation anywhere in the national dialogue? The other night in the presidential debate, I think it was the second question asked, the question was asked about climate change. And I'm not going to comment on what either candidate for vice president said, but my point would be a question about climate change is really not a question about conservation and how we manage our lands and how we have scientific information making decisions. The real question, I think, before us is, are we going to continue to allow individuals who are not trained as career professionals in science to make decisions that impact fisheries and wildlife resources? More and more, and the line is ballot box biology, but more and more states are turning to referendums for how to manage wildlife and fisheries than they are turning to career professionals who've been trained in how to manage wildlife and fisheries. So with an election a month away, we don't hear anything about conservation. We hear something about climate change, but we don't hear it in the context of what it does to affect or impact the landscape. There are now lawsuits in the West over the proposals from the Bureau of Land Management to put massive quantities of land behind fences for solar farms, blocking off migratory bird routes, blocking off migratory land animal routes. Elk, deer, antelope in particular are going to face tens of square miles of impediments, millions of acres in the end, but when you block them off and put a fence around every solar farm, it's going to absolutely disrupt the migratory paths that have long been established by ungulates, and it's also going to impact the migratory paths established by bird life. And this is all being done on a fast track that would never be permitted under any other form of energy, and the Western states are saying, not so fast. You're not just going to put solar farms, or in some cases wind farms, across huge amounts of public land in states that we live in and in states that wildlife use because it's an edict from Washington. So I think that is going to be perhaps more of interest to the American public, is how this is going to be handled under the Green New Deal, if you will, if it survives, or simply under the quest for renewable energy, which I think we're all for, but not when it comes with big environmental consequences. And so we talk about the need to curtail oil and gas drilling because of its environmental consequences. There's no discussion about the environment, or very little discussion about the environmental consequences of huge solar farms and huge wind farms. And wind farms in Illinois, as we've talked about, on the Upper Illinois River, are absolutely having an impact on migratory birds. We know that from watching. We don't know that from science, because the science hasn't been done, which should have been done before the projects were put into place. And that's what Western states are saying now. Before you go and put hundreds of thousands of acres behind fences, let's figure out what the impact is going to be, rather than put them up and then realize we've had a catastrophic impact. So those are some of the discussions that might be helpful in the remaining month of the election cycle to understand where the candidates, not only in the presidential election, but also candidates in the Senate and in House elections, stand on this, because this is going to determine much of how the landscape is used in the coming years. So I'll be back in a moment. And when I do come back, I want to talk about something that is really interesting, the removal of dams. And a big one's come down. Hope you're enjoying the show. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and thank you for being with me. As I mentioned before the break, we're going to talk about dams, but before I go there, I do hope in the last month we do get some discussion about conservation. It's a national issue, and it deserves our national attention. The largest dam removal project in U.S. history is complete. The dam on the Klamath River, the last of the four dams in the Klamath River, have been taken out. This is a very significant win for fisheries populations, and it's also a significant win for tribal nations of the Oregon-California border who for decades have fought to restore the river to its natural state. There were four major hydroelectric dams, the Iron Gate Dam, the Capo Dam 1 and 2, and the J.C. Boyle Dam. For J.C. Boyle, his dam has been, he was named after him, it's gone. This allows the region's iconic salmon populations, for the first time in 80 years, to be able to swim freely up the Klamath River and its tributaries. And they've not been able to do this actually in almost a century. This is a big deal because it shows that it can be done. And the Pacific Northwest, as we've talked about from time to time, exists because of cheap hydroelectric power. But the cheap hydroelectric power has decimated, actually it's done more than decimated, it's wiped out fisheries runs in many rivers. It's severely degraded fishery runs in other rivers. It has destroyed the economic and tourism impacts that these rivers, when flowing freely, brought to America. And I mentioned a few weeks ago, it'd be interesting to look in hindsight, would we have built all these dams on the Klamath and the Columbia and the Snake and every river in the West that we've put these huge dams in that have blocked the migration of fish? Would we put these dams in if we really understood the consequences? The consequences we now know are the complete wipeout and putting on the endangered species list. Species that provided, in today's dollars, would have provided hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, of economic value. And we did this so that we could settle the Pacific Northwest, so that we could irrigate all kinds of cropland, so that cities could survive and thrive through what was very cheap hydroelectric power. There certainly were lots of other ways to power these areas. They just weren't cheap the way hydroelectric was. They weren't convenient. But with a century of hindsight, I have to believe absolutely we wouldn't have built these dams. We would have found other ways, just as we have across the rest of the country, to provide power and energy to metropolitan areas and also to agriculture. But we did this, and now in California on the Klamath River, we've taken the four out, and there are going to be many more dams coming out. The other thing that, of course, does happen is that the water behind the dams, in other words, it's backing up water, as we see in the Fox River and elsewhere, the water becomes very, these lakes silt in. The sediments coming down, the rivers gets trapped by these dams, and over time, these huge reservoirs fill in with silt. That's a naturally occurring occurrence. So the Klamath River is absolutely a test case. I would offer here on the Great Outdoors Show this morning, it's going to be, they're going to see more dams removed, and in the coming decades, we're going to see some dams that people never thought would be removed come down. because there are other ways in which we can provide water and energy, and we can try to reestablish fisheries runs before they go extinct. And the Columbia River Basin, as some of you may know, was the largest commercial fishery in the world. It surpassed any other commercial fishery. Then the dams were built, and today the Columbia River Basin is just a drip of what it was as a commercial fishery. Is it possible to bring it back? It is. I think the science is there, and if the politics were there and more dams came out and we had ways to replace the energy that these dams provide, we could have a win-win. We could have lots of agriculture in the Pacific Northwest. We certainly could provide energy to metropolitan areas, and we could restore fish runs that, if enabled to be restored, would be worth just an incredible amount of money to the economy, and also would be doing something right for the world. We're close. We're on the precipice. If fish runs go extinct, they don't come back. So that's what's going on with the dams in the Pacific Northwest. I have a couple moments left. I want to talk very briefly about something that happened with Greenpeace. It's been in the news a little bit, and it's really quite interesting, and that is the subject of Greenpeace being sued because it has interfered with commerce. It's always the other way around, that Greenpeace is the one doing the suing. Well, there's an interesting story brewing out of Texas, which, if successful, will absolutely change the way lawsuits are handled. And that is that a company is suing Greenpeace essentially for interfering with its lawful right to extract energy, and suing Greenpeace for interfering with the image of the country, of the company. If this succeeds, then it's highly likely that Greenpeace, which is a pretty radical group, would be in serious financial trouble. And when I say a pretty radical group, they are the group that has committed terrorist acts. They, in many cases, have been considered a terrorist organization. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out, but it's possible that we could see a change in the way some of these really extreme conservation, no, they're not conservation groups, some of the really extreme litigious environmental groups are treated by the courts if they, in turn, are to be held liable for some of the work that they have been doing in the legal world. This will take years to work its way through, but definitely it's a sign that there could be a change coming in how environmentalism, radical environmentalism, is litigated. And if the environmental groups have to pay for radical environmentalist lawsuits, there are going to be a lot fewer lawsuits, and that might not be a bad thing. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the Great Outdoors Show. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more in the great outdoors. And as I said, seasons are opening up across America this weekend. I hope that you're able to partake. And most of all, be safe in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.